brother was extremely spoilt.
Yeah, I think we should begin now. I'm Christine Polson, and I'm moderating this panel on Mr. Lucky getting away with murder. First thing I must mention before I forget all about it is that the person who asks the most scintillating question later on wins a bag of books. So you can be pondering that. I'm going to begin with a quotation from Oscar Wilde. Lady Bracknell's comment that the good end happily and the bad unhappily, that is what fiction means. I'm not sure that that's ever been completely true of crime fiction, and it certainly isn't completely true of it today. But I want to begin by introducing the panel, and as I do so, I want to ask them, do people get away with murder in your novels? And if not, why not? So, can I begin with Lynn, please? You've written a series of seven novels, is it now?
Mm-hmm.
On with Rhoda McLeod, formidable and very human forensic scientist as the main character. And your most recent, The Reborn, has just been published in paperback. So are you going to let them get away with it?
I love this question because a couple of books back, a book called Easy Kill, I wrote two endings. And in one of the endings, I captured the person who committed the crimes. And in the other one, they know who it is, but... he escapes, because I thought I could, you know, pull him out in another book and have him in the background. So I sent the one where he got away to my editor. That was the first time she'd read the script. You know, I just sent it down, didn't say anything. She read it, she got back to me a couple of days later, and she said, I love the book, but you can't do that. We had a sort of discussion about it, but her feeling was that the structure of the books demanded a bigger resolution at the end than that offered. So she was very happy to hear that there was another ending there waiting for her. I thought it was really good to write both because it helped me decide what one worked the best as well. So I sent her down the second one and she was perfectly happy. So I think you've got to think about your readers as well and what your series is doing. I think you can get away with some things. For example, the first book in the series is called Driftnet, and you're introduced to Rhona McLeod, and she turns up at a scene of crime and she thinks the 17-year-old boy is the son she gave up for adoption 17 years before because he looks so like her. And you follow her searching for... She finds out fairly quickly it's not her son, obviously. But she's searching... She sets off in a search for her son as well as for the killer of this boy because she feels really personally involved in it now. And one of the issues in that book, and I won't spoil it for you by telling you what it is, but there is somebody in there that does get away insofar as they're involved in it, but they're very high up in society and the door's shut and the police can't get enough evidence, but they deeply suspect that this character has had an involvement in this. But I had a lot of fun in the one that comes out in August, so you're talking about 8 books later, he gets his comeuppance, so you have to wait, but he does get it.
Thanks, man. Dolores, you write a series featuring Jack Haldane, the dashing...
Oh, yes, he's gorgeous.
ex-First World War pilot and crime writer. And I think your work is based very much really on the style and the atmosphere of Golden Age crime
Absolutely.
Fiction.
And all my own private fantasies of what the ideal man should really be like.
Well, perhaps we won't go there just yet.
just read the books.
But, So you're really writing the kind of novel where the hangman is waiting.
Oh, yeah. But if I fall in love with the villain, as I do occasionally, he has a beautiful death. He can, for instance, drive his Bentley off a cliff, and everybody can stand around and, oh, he's so sad. But no, he has to be seriously good looking for that to happen. Yeah. So they never actually get away with murder. Well, at least not in the beginning, because of course, if they didn't get away with it in the first place, you wouldn't have a story, would you? But no, at the end, you know, justice is done, chaos is organised, and order is restored. And that's the classic recipe for the Golden Age detective story. And that's what I thoroughly enjoy reading and enjoy writing. So some of the Golden Age people, if they fell in love with their big villains, like Bulldog Drummond's created, obviously fell in love with his big villain, the evil Carl. And he kept on coming back, book after book, in the most improbable way. But he was far too good a villain to lose. And, of course, you've got Fu Manchu, haven't you? At the end of every Fu Manchu book, you know, I will return, Dixon Man, he says, you know, in a Chinese accent. And so, you know, it seems quite edgy in a way to say, oh, you know, Patricia Highsmith with Mr. Ripley, you know, that he gets away with murder. But in fact, you can be just as hokey and let your villain get away with it as just having him, you know, delivered to justice.
Thanks very much, Dolores. Stella, your series character is Liz Carlisle, who's female intelligence officer, and your new novel, Riptide, is out in July, I think.
Yes, that's right.
So, again, do you ever let anybody off? Or are you tempted?
Well, my books are about the sort of race between the intelligence services in the form of, in my books, of MI5 and Liz Carlisle and her team, and those who wish to do us harm, i.e. terrorists or spies or whatever. And so, like Dolores, by definition, before the intelligence services get going, something must have happened, because they get a small piece of information that sort of triggers off their investigation. So somebody is getting away with something at the outset, either with planning or with actually carrying out a terrorist operation or an espionage or an infiltration or whatever it is. As the books go on, though, the forces of law and order in the form of Liz Carlisle and her team tend to win, but they don't win totally. In other words, there's always some ambivalence around with the people who are trying to do us harm. I mean, what is their reason? And sometimes, as in my first book, At Risk, the reason is a reason that, I won't tell you what it is, but it's a reason that I think we can all sympathise with, why this young man had come to this country to carry out what was in effect a terrorist operation. And in the book, which is going to be published in July, which is called Riptide, again, you are invited to sympathise with a young Birmingham Muslim who finds himself with a group of pirates in Somalia. The issue in the book is, how did he get there? Who's persuaded him to do this? And who are you going to blame? You know, are you blaming the people, the imam in this case, who has radicalised him and persuaded him that it's appropriate to go off and carry out terrorist operations, or are you to blame this young man for what he's doing? So there's ambivalence in all these things, I think. But at the end, I have to say, because of my origins, the forces of law and order in the form of Liz Carlisle and her team usually prevent the harm that's intended, and somebody is brought to justice. Though in my previous book, somebody disappeared in a boat, and we don't know whether he's going to come back later on. So, you know, there is ambivalence. I think there's ambivalence in all things.
Thanks very much, Stella. Linda, you've written mostly about true crime, and I guess that means that the very fact that we know about it means that they didn't get away with it. But you've also written a fascinating book on chloroform, mm-hmm. and your new novel, your first novel, The Poisonous Seed, set in 19th century Bayswater, has just come out. Mm. So again, would you countenance in fiction, at any rate, allowing, where we can do whatever we want, allowing someone to get off scot-free?
Well, the thing is, I do live most of my time in the 19th century, and I know that at that this particular point, that actually trying to prove anything was actually very much more difficult than it is now. And lots of people who we're looking at it, you know jolly well they did it, but you can't actually prove it, and they usually did get off. So when I was writing fiction, I was well aware of this, and but being a lover of these, the sort of the real classic whodunit, the real mystery with the puzzle, which your sleuth comes along and has to solve all these little questions, I wanted to get to the end and wrap things up and have everything just snick into place. And that was what I did right up until the end, when I realised that there was just one little bit where there was a question mark, and it just felt right, and I can't really justify it any more than that, to say it felt right to me that at that particular point there was going to be a little question mark. Most all the big questions that are asked right at the beginning of the book are answered, but there's a little question at the end. It's the first one in the series, I may come back to it, but I just wanted to leave that. It's almost a kind of debating point, really. I'm not sure I know the answer, and I may find it out at some time in the future. But it'll be quite fun coming back to that one and just seeing the knock-on effect maybe years later of that little hanging question. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, I'd like to throw the discussion open to the rest of the whole panel. And I want to ask something that interests me very much as a crime writer. Do we have a responsibility as writers not to let murderers get away with murder? I feel as a writer that on the whole I do. I might not necessarily feel that someone had to end up in a court of law or in prison, but there must be some kind of redressing of the moral balance. Of course, real life isn't like that. So do you feel moral responsibilities? I've got the impression, Stella, that you probably did.
Well, I feel that the only responsibility of a crime writer is to write something that people will actually enjoy reading,
yeah.
Basically. So beyond that, if you can sort of justify letting your villain get away with it, letting your murderer get away with it, to the point where people are actually going to go with you in reading that story, then I think, you know, you're justified in doing that. I myself would not wish to do that, because what I'm trying to do is to write something that's moderately realistic about the way things do actually happen in investigations carried out by MI5. So although obviously I'm writing fiction, and you know, I couldn't put my hand in my heart and say that everything that happens in my novels is actually going to happen in real life, I do feel the responsibility, really, to my form of profession to make it seem as realistic as possible. And what that means is that ultimately, in some cases, you know, they won't get sufficient intelligence to prevent something awful happening, you know, like the bombs on the tube on 7/7, etc. But once they have got an investigation in their hands, then they are going to carry it through to success. And so that's me, you know, putting myself and my background and my moral attitudes into what I'm writing. But as I say, ultimately, I don't think that a crime writer has got the moral responsibility to do that.
Does everyone agree?
Yeah. I mean, really, you write a book for an audience, you want to, I agree with Stella there. We're in the business of entertainment here. We're not in the business of pontificating on people's morals. What I find fascinating about this, though, there's also this, you know, can people who do bad things be redeemed? And bear in mind also, there's a lot of people in prison who shouldn't be there. I mean, I'm very interested in that because of the forensic. The whole world has changed in the last, you know, 20 years. And there is many people being released from prison via forensic, as are being put inside using forensic. And I explored that a lot in a book called Final Cup, where somebody was locked up for a crime. And really, did they do that crime? And in The Reborn, which is the paperback one out now, there's a guy locked up, it's Carstairs Prison, although I don't call it Carstairs, and he's in there because he murdered his baby. And but he's become a sort of Jimmy Boyle character. I don't know if you knew about Jimmy Boyle. Was a famous Scottish killer who now lives in Cannes, up in the hill in a villa, and is a sculptor. And his life was turned round in Peterhead Prison, and he's become, you know, the successful artist. Well, the character I have in the prison, it makes these reborn babies for families who have lost a young child and want a replica. I know it sounds horrible, but a replica child. And he's become really good at that. And it looks as if he's sort of redeemed himself by helping bereaved parents. I won't tell you what, but it was interesting just to explore, I mean, who is totally bad? And when you were talking about your characters, why did they end up doing that thing? I think that's something that we explore, you know, and perhaps that's the morality we should be thinking about, because nobody's totally bad or totally good. It's the darkness and the light in the characters, even the bad ones, that I think makes crime interesting to write and good to read.
Mm-hmm. What about writers who seem to go over completely to the dark side? I'm thinking of, you know, Hannibal Lecter and Thomas Harris. I mean, that is, for me, a step too far.
As far as I'm concerned, it's a step too far as well. I mean, fair enough if people want to buy, read, watch the films, you know, do, by all means. But I don't like it. I don't like seeing something that I think is horrible and evil being glamorised like that. And that's quite simple, because if you're talking about violence, it's you know, it can have a glamour. We were having a discussion about boxing the other night, and which I quite enjoy. But my friend, I think it was Jane, said that she didn't like. No, it's Rebecca, said that she didn't like the audience, and I have to agree with her. guiltily aware of having been the audience on television. You know, I don't like nasty things being glamorised, and you know, there's a lot in nasty things, but you know, sadism and things. It's not. It can be glamorised. You know, there is a glamour about it, but and I think it's quite a dangerous line to go down. Linda, what do you feel?
I mean, there are many villains who are attractive in their own way, in that they might, but they, in films they always have the best lines. Notice that, and they might be quite dashing, and you know, and they might be very clever, and so they will have some qualities that you can say, oh yes, that chap's very, you know, he's brilliant, he's clever, he's witty. It's a pity he's the villain, and I know he's going to fall off a cliff at the end of the of the film, but that's as it should be. There is something slightly sadistic in the sort of the glamorising of the, first of all, someone like Lecter, who of course is completely unrealistic as a serial killer in the way he operates and his intellect and so on. So he isn't even a real person. The person he caught is based on a real person, and is quite accurately portrayed. And we don't really want to speak about him because he wasn't a nice person. But Lecter is somehow made glamorous, but only because he's not realistic. You know, and there is this idea that murderers are somehow very clever, which is not really true.
Do you think there's something about women writing crime which means that we avoid violence? Or is that not the case? I don't know. I mean, I can't.
Oh, no, that, no, it's definitely not true.
How much violence is one prepared to go?
Well, I'll be honest now. I think it's very unfair that women are castigated for writing dark crime novels, and yet men writing the same and even more violent, that's perfectly acceptable. I don't really understand where that argument comes from. But most of the violence that is supposed to be in a novel if you actually go and look at the page, you find it's not there. It's in your head.
Mm-hmm.
Because a really good scene, you leave your audience to imagine. It's like the films, you know, mm-hmm. where the person is behind the door, and we know they're behind the door, but the person about to open it doesn't. That's actually far more frightening. And I've been in situations, I can't remember, someone said to me, oh, but there was that bit in that scene. And we went and looked at the scene, and I hadn't written that.
Mm.
They had imagined that.
Yeah, yeah,
and it's far scarier mm-hmm. that way round.
Yeah.
But I do believe that, I mean, everybody has their method of writing, and it's up to you to decide how much you're going to portray in the page. But I would definitely say less is more.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I feel a bit, you know, I loved Agatha Christie. I read every book. But everybody that was murdered, there was never any blood.
Mm.
The body lay on the carpet, and obviously the carpet didn't need dry cleaned after it. Now, that is totally unrealistic. What that's saying to you is murder is dead easy. You just bump somebody off. They don't bleed. Nothing bad happens. It's nice and tidy.
Yeah.
It's clean. They get lifted away, and it's, you know, and you investigate it. That's not what murder is. Murder is a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing, and we should look at it in its truth and reality.
Mm-hmm.
That's my feeling.
Yes, I think we expect different things from different sort of subgenre, don't we? And I doubt if Agatha Christie did encourage people to actually go out and with a small gun and put a neat little hole in somebody's. Yeah. Forehead. Yesterday at one of the panels, I think Peter James said that he felt confident that that the darkness was already out there, and he wasn't putting ideas into people's heads that they didn't already have.
Can I say, I mean, from time immemorial, long before people wrote crime fiction, people have been blaming the existence of crime on whatever happened to be there at the time. In the early days, of course, it was the most violent book was inspiring people to go out and commit crimes was the Bible, because a lot of stuff happens in the Bible, and lots of people say, oh, well, I heard all these voices, you see, and I went out and committed these crimes. And no one's going to suggest you ban the Bible. It's just that, you know, yes, Peter was quite right. The darkness is out there, and a mind which is disturbed will simply latch on to whatever happens to be there at the time, be it a video game or the Bible or whatever. And then, unfortunately, it's that particular genre that gets blamed for it.
I think the interesting thing is the sort of moral ambiguity here, and that's why I don't find Agatha Christie particularly interesting, because everything is so simple somehow. You know, there's a bad person who wants something which they think they can get by killing another person, and then somebody comes along and investigates it, and it's all kind of tied up neatly, and as you say, it's all clean and wholesome somehow.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there is the sort of moral ambiguity in everything, all these situations that we write about as crime writers, and even, mm-hmm. you know, going back to my own area, subgenre, or whatever you like to call it, there's inevitably going to be moral ambiguity in the way intelligence services obtain information.
Mm-hmm.
And investigate situations. And one of the biggest moral ambiguities, which I explore in at least two of my books, is this relationship between the intelligence officer and their human source of information. And the question there is, how much risk can you put somebody in order to give you the information that you need to investigate, you know, the terrorist plot or whatever it is. And, I mean, that's answered it's the question of how serious is the issue that you're attempting to prevent, and, you know, to that extent you can ask people to put themselves at risk. But these go on, and in two of my books the human source is actually killed because the intelligence service, for one reason or another, has not fulfilled their side of the deal. In other words, they haven't looked after them properly. So I think it's those kind of ambiguities mm-hmm. that are interesting in crime fiction of all kinds, rather than, you know, the Agatha Christie type,
mm-hmm.
bang, bang, you know, who did it kind of thing, sort it out, here's a policeman, and we all go home.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're thinking about moral ambiguity and about women crime writers too. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't forget that Patricia Highsmith is perhaps still the most chilling exponent of the novel with the murderer as hero.
Mm-hmm.
And she admitted that she really liked writing about people who were free of, who were psychopaths, sociopaths, who were free of the constraints that were... Mm-hmm. Ordinary people were obliged to live under.
Yeah, and that's been explored, in philosophy forever. Jean Paul Sartre and L'Étranger, just step out. What would it feel like just to step out and murder someone?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the crime writing, in Scotland sort of comes out of the Robert Louis Stevenson background of Jekyll and Hyde.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we don't often have books, crime books set in Scotland where people kill one another for the manor house or for the inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really think of any at the moment currently exploring that sort of puzzle country house murder. I could be wrong. It's more about that, it's about the human being. And in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, it was the two parts of your character. And I think a lot of people, I know I like crime books because it explores, they explore what we could be. And it's a scary thing to look at and what circumstances might land us in that position. Ourselves.
Mm-hmm. I think that, again, it is the psychology of crime, both real and fiction, that interests me. And I get people sort of, usually if it's someone from a newspaper, say, "Oh, and is what you write really gruesome?" So that word always comes up. And I said, gruesome is irrelevant to me. What I'm interested in is the psychology, the relationships between the people, why the events happened in the way that they did, and just exploring all of that is the fascination of it.
If I, just stick up really for the Agatha Christie school of crime writing, which I am a deep fan. In Agatha Christie, and certainly in anything I've written, the murder is never done sort of as a whimsical act, of fun, because we say Agatha Christie as if we're all playing, as if she's playing Cluedo, and she actually never does that, and I certainly don't. The murder is committed because at that time it seems like the most logical thing for the person to do. It's a way out of an extreme difficulty. And I imagine there's been plenty of murders committed because it is the way out of an extreme and pressing difficulty, and I'm quite sure that if you've managed to lose all your money and you're looking at rich Aunt Ethel, you might think, she'd be better as an empty space, wouldn't she? goodbye to rich Aunt Ethel, And then, of course, a Lord Peter Wimsey, the nosy bugger, could come along and spoil the party, Or, if there happens to be no Sherlock Holmes or Peter Wimsey at hand, then you can live with your ill-gotten gains perfectly happily, But I don't see why, just because it's not sort of a psychopathic sort of crime, it's any actually less realistic. Why you can't just murder as a sort of business, really?
And Agatha Christie was a master of the puzzle. I taught maths for years, and it's the sort of the mathematics of the puzzle that fascinated me about those type of books. You were really going into them to solve a puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of crime people read crime because it's a very interactive genre, because you are part of the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
So you're trying to solve it as you read the book,
mm-hmm.
and you feel an ownership of that, of the story, because, and that's why you should never cheat your readers.
Yes.
You should never suddenly produce something, or an act of God, that falls off.
Yeah. But then Agatha Christie does.
I know she does. But then it was allowed then. Shakespeare did it too and stuff.
I think any kind of crime fiction
to me anyway, it starts off by asking a question, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think whatever that question is right at the beginning of the book, it really should be answering it right at the end.
Yeah.
So the question is usually who committed the murder.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's different.
Yeah.
In Columbo, it's not who committed the murder, because we know that. So the question is how is he going to find out the
answer?
Yeah. In the Dexter books, we know who commits the murder, it's Dexter. But the question is, how is he going to get
away with it?
Yeah. And actually, we're talking about people getting away with murder. The people who have been getting away with murder in the Dexter books are the people he's polishing off.
Yes, that's
not
true.
Always.
Well, yeah, he does what? But if he does kill an innocent person by accident, it's really a terrible thing for him. It's an emotional difficulty. But
pretty terrible for the person he's fucked off as well.
Yeah,
whoops.
The thing about him is that from the point of view of the serial killer who has actually no emotions, that is actually, I think, drawn really well.
Mm.
But he has to be made acceptable to the reader. So, in other words, he only kills really bad people who deserve it, which is quite unrealistic. But frankly, it's so well written, I'm really quite happy to go along with it. And I really enjoy those books.
Can I open out the discussion for the audience as well and invite some questions now? Yes. The question was, I think it was your detective. Yes.
Are many of your villains, if you want to call them that, women, and if not, why not?
Do you have female villains?
I have females who are involved in villainy, so to speak, but they're not necessarily the lead. But that's not through any kind of sexist attitude to villainy, I don't think. It's just that it's about realism, I suspect, that the things I'm writing about normally are actually done by men. But you've given me an idea and I'm going to go away.
I can't answer that. I'd be giving away the plot, wouldn't I?
Don't give away the plot. Yeah. Never give away the plot. I've got female protagonist. And I don't want to give away plots either. I think it's down to, again, realism. And at the end of the day, I start off the book, I'll explain how it happens. You know, I have an opening scene, and I think you're right, you walk in and there it's questions. And people think a forensic scientist is about tests, and that's completely not true. When a forensic expert walks onto a scene, they ask questions of the scene. That's how it begins. So I just know the opening scene, I have no idea what happens after that. So who pops up as a villain? I have not planned. I have no idea. And it's because I am Rona MacLeod. I don't mean I am Rona, she's me. But what I mean to say is I only know what she knows. And therefore, it's as I discover things. So I have no plan of action, and I have no idea why it's happened or who's done it. So it comes out of the story who turns out to be the villain, and I haven't planned that in advance.
Zoris, have you got some juicy female
villains? I've got some very juicy female villains, yes. But I wasn't answering the question because my protagonist is a man, you know, and it was, if you've got if your protagonist is a female, do you have female villains, you know? But I thoroughly enjoy having female villains, and I'm particularly good at femme fatales because I can project myself into you know, because I mean look like this, but actually I'm
inside,
I'm dashing and beautiful, you know, and men throw roses at me, you know, this sort of thing. So yes, there's an awful lot of wish fulfillment going on. Yes, and yes, I do a very good meaty femme fatale. You know.
Any more? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually love the Agatha Christie.
Yeah.
But people do get away with murder in everyday life.
Mm.
And
yes.
I think years ago that everything was cut and dry. You know, it was easier to say you this person is guilty. Now with all the forensic medicine, we've made it more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Well, no, I read, about, I don't know, hundreds, maybe thousands of 19th century cases, and I'm frequently grieved at the thought of how many people got off, because I just thought, oh my heavens, if they'd had fingerprints, if they had DNA, that would have been, you know, absolutely banked to rights. We'd have known what would happen in a few minutes. But in fact, so many people were simply given the benefit of the doubt and walked free. And I've just seen this happen again and again and again. I'm sorry, I disagree with it. I've just seen so much of it. It was not cut and dried then.
Yeah, but hasn't it given us a lot of interesting things to talk about? I mean, just think, there's a whole bunch of journalists and book writers who would not have a living if Jack the Ripper had been nailed.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
And there's a sub industry, you know, who killed Charles Bravo, you know.
Yes.
Wow.
It's interesting that it's the unsolved cases of the past that constantly fascinate people.
Yeah.
The case that first really got me into being published was the Adelaide Bartlett case of 1886. And after she was acquitted, the murder of her husband, which I'm quite sure she did, someone quite famously said, well, now she's been acquitted, perhaps she'd like to tell us how she did it. But
yeah.
She never did. She
yeah.
never let on.
Yeah.
But that, again, was you know, a complete failure of forensics and everything in that case.
Yeah. There's no doubt forensics doesn't solve everything. You know, I mean, that most recent case in London of that serial rapist who'd been operating for, I don't know, about 15 years, and they think could be 100 out there of women that he had attacked.
Mm.
And despite everything, they still, you know, it took a long, long time to capture him.
Yes.
So it doesn't... I'm reminded of this wonderful photograph I saw. I did a diploma in forensic science at Glasgow, and they showed us this. There was a World Ends murders. That was two young girls disappeared from the Royal Mile pub called the World's End, and they found their bodies down the coast on the beach. They knew who the two men were who had done it, but they couldn't get them on the evidence. Now, this is quite a number of years ago, so they brought out the forensics again. But anyway, we were shown in the course the body on the beach, and all the way round it were these policeman Plod's shoes, like 2 inches from the body. And you looked at that, and it's immediate gasp.
No.
You think, oh my God, look at that crime scene. It's totally devastated by all these feet.
Well,
thank God we're not still in that situation.
Yeah.
Well, again, in Victorian times, the first thing you did when you found the body was you removed it. Usually the nearest pub for some reason, but anyway. Yeah. But actually, this is quite interesting about people getting away with murder, because when people have got away with it maybe for 20 or 30 years, and then all of a sudden, DNA, lovely.
Yeah.
You're
I loved that.
And one of the things that they always seem to say is, do you know, I've spent the last 20, 30 years waiting for that
for
knock
that
on the
door.
Happen. So have they got away with it, really? They've had this life of it's constantly been on their mind, waiting to be arrested. I mean, the guy who did the Yorkshire Ripper spoof tapes, he was got DNA, and he'd been waiting for that knock on the door.
I think there's some people are not waiting, they're going on doing it. A man who's just been brought to court for only, it's really 1930s crime. He's kept on marrying women and murdering them for the insurance money. So he certainly wasn't. Well, if he was waiting for the knock on the door, it wasn't deterring him from...
It doesn't sound like he's been racked by guilt, does he?
No. Any more questions, that lady there?
I'm quite interested in the origins of sort of a moral compass. I don't want to be too personal, but do any of you have anything in your background, in your family backgrounds, that led you into wanting to write crime, or was it something that you read? How was your interest captured by crime and by morality?
Well, sorry.
No, you go ahead. Linda, yes.
I blame it on two people, my mother and Edgar Lustgarten, because when I was a little girl, there was this program on the television. My mother and I used to watch it, and he'd be sitting there intoning the murderer crept up upon his victim, you know, maybe going, ooh, like that. And so it was wonderful. So really from the age of about 10, I was reading about crime. And the only crime connection in my family that I know about is that my paternal grandfather came from a little village, a tiny village in Poland, which was the same village that Aaron Kosminski came from. And I'm sort of hoping they might have been related, because, you know, it's just the outside chance of related to Jack the Ripper.
Oh,
you know, and I just think, yeah, how cool would that be, really? You
Your
know?
Publicist would love that.
Oh, dream come true. Dream come true, yes.
I was just going to say my father was a detective inspector in Greenock Police Force, yeah. And he had three daughters. I'm the middle one. And in those days, they never told you anything, you know. But we always knew when something really bad had happened, you know, when he would come home. And be swiftly, him and my mum would go into the kitchen and the door would be shut. So some sort of... And he would give you coded messages, because then you didn't talk about that. It was never on the telly, you know. When you think of the details you get of cases now on the television when they report them, and that never happened. I feel he died before I wrote my first book, so I've never been able to say, sorry, I didn't really listen to you when you were trying to protect us. But we just thought, as, you know, teenage girls, that he was just being fussy, so... my background.
And mine comes from having worked for 27 years for MI5 and having thought a lot, you know, about these issues during my career, and having also been a chronic reader of thrillers of all kinds, and putting the two together, I suppose, when I got to the end of my working life and had space, then these two interests came together. And so it was natural, I suppose, that what I started to write about was things connected with the issues that I've been thinking about for all those years.
Well, it's very straightforward, really. I love two sorts of books, science fiction and detective stories. And when I actually wanted to come to write something that had an odds-on chance of getting published, science fiction had virtually died. It was all fantasy, and I don't fancy doing Conan-type sub-Lord of the Rings books. So I embraced the other alternative. And, you know, I haven't got... none of my family are even remotely related to Jack the Ripper or anything like this. I mean, you know, it's dreadful, but wouldn't it be fun if they were, you know? But no, it's all from a standing start. And, yeah... It was only because sci-fi had gone out of fashion.
Yes, just maybe.
I'm just wondering if any of you has considered writing or creating a character who does get away with murder for morally justifiable grounds. And I use Agatha Christie as an example. Mm. The murder on the Orient Express, for instance. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where the reader is invited to agree that, yeah. Mm.
Justice has been served, yes. Even though no one has been brought to justice.
Oh, yeah. That's. I would find that totally morally okay, because I do find that Murder on the Orient Express, I mean, it's hilarious and it's ridiculous, but it's very good fun and morally okay. Yes, when justice can't be achieved by legal means. I mean, I'd hate to have anyone endorse that as a principle.
Very, very dangerous
principle indeed. But between the covers of a book, yes, it's satisfying. Yeah. And as Stella said at the beginning, this is fiction after all that we're talking about. It is not real life.
Yeah. Certainly.
As long as you don't present it as a moral... justified option. I think that way of madness lies.
Yes.
I was going to say, what I find quite interesting is the idea of having a character. I'm working on another series at the moment. Having a character who is your protagonist, but doesn't always work within the law. It works outside the law, and there's loads of those about in various books, but you really want them to succeed, but the law is awkward and stopping them finding or doing what's required. So I quite like that idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Newmark,
yes, I was just going to say, a group of us heard Andrew Taylor speak last week, and he made the point that these sometimes in small villages or towns where everybody knows everybody else. In the past, he gave the example of a woman who killed her husband, and he was well known in the town that he beat his wife. He was very abusive to her. The forensics today would probably show that she did it, but she was acquitted because apparently the people knew that he deserved it.
Mm-hmm. And just not too long ago, I saw that in the Lizzie Borden case, which I'm sure you're all familiar mm-hmm.
yeah.
with, mm-hmm. at that time it was whispered and well known in the town, apparently, that he sexually abused Lizzie, the father sexually mm-hmm. abused Lizzie.
Mm-hmm.
So she, despite the evidence that she probably did it, the jury agreed.
Mm.
You know, I don't know if it's not guilty or not proven anyway.
No.
Mm-hmm.
That way, whereas today she would probably have to argue the sexual abuse part of it.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
I think one more question. Mm-hmm. Sorry, mm-hmm. Yes, we've just got time for.
Yeah. How does the sophistication of the audience today change the way you've had to change your writing of books? The fact that people are more aware of ways to go ahead and deal with or resolve crimes or identify criminals, does that make your writing more difficult, or how have you changed?
I feel I could answer your question better, Bill, if I'd actually started writing about 100 years ago and
yeah.
was still doing it, you know. But I only actually got the first book published in 2007, so the audience then is the audience now. But I do think, no, to be serious, I think you've got to be as clever as you can. Whether that's clever enough is, of course, you know, is something I can't possibly say. But yeah, people are far more sophisticated because we've got so much more information, haven't we? You know, you turn on the television, and it's exactly as you said, Lynn. You know, there's details of cases.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
Stella, you know, in your books, the you know, doings of the security services are revealed, you know, and this stuff, it just was not available years ago, so you can't do anything. Well, you can, but it's very difficult to stray too far away from what people know to be how things really are, I think.
I mean, you can still read Lord Peter Wimsey, for example,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, go along with it. But when you think what he does, I mean, here's this amateur gent who poles up onto a murder scene and starts interfering and taking bits
yeah.
away
yeah.
and
yeah.
all that
yeah.
sort of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you couldn't get away with writing that stuff now because people would just say, you know.
No, not in the modern, not
no.
in modern
but
context.
But you can still read
couldn't.
It and
yeah.
enjoy
yeah.
it,
yeah.
can't
yeah.
you?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think one of the problems we have writing in the present day is not so much the forensics as the phone. The mobile phone, because if you even watch TV drama now, so much of the story is conducted on the phone. How do you write a story? Because people, you know, in the past, people had to get from one place to the other to find something out. Everything is instantly available now, and this phone business, that I think that's the biggest problem. Or you get it on Twitter, you know, you already know the answer on Twitter. It's keeping a good story and holding people as attention with, you know, and trying to avoid being constantly on the phone or the internet.
Yes.
Or
having meetings in my
case. Yes.
Well, one reason why it's very good to set a book in a reasonably well-defined area
mm-hmm.
where you've got a sort of a gossip thing, that if it's in the past.
Yeah.
So it, you know, in 19th century Bayswater, the power of gossip. And, you know, the servant telling
mm-hmm.
her boyfriend who told
the
aunt
Twitter of the
day.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
it just goes all around the area.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
we do
yeah.
have
yeah.
a sort of 19th century Twitter feed
Twitter
going
day.
On
yeah.
in that area. And in fact,
trending topic is today's murder.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, the power of rumour and gossip shouldn't be underestimated in the past.
I'll have to draw things to a close there. And before I ask you to thank our panel, books, I've decided... Your question was the best one. But hang on, wait. Yes.
Stella Rimmington is actually moderating the next panel and therefore has to meet the authors who she's going to be interviewing. So if you're happy with this, Stella, it might be best for people who want to have their book signed if they have the book signed by Stella
after
the
next
panel.
Okay.
Yes, and the others will be in the next room to sign books. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.